always nice to hear the lightning seeds life of Riley here at BBC Radio Oxford. Phil Riley's my guest. He's 56, by his own admission, has been at various stages of his life a smoker, clinically obese, chronically unfit, and a heavy drinker.
Boy, those are the days.
I've enjoyed saying those words, I really have. He's also one of the top radio men in the UK, named one of the 40 most influential people in commercial radio's first 40 years. He's also my old boss, which is why I took great delight in uttering those words.
You're going to pay me back now in the next 20 minutes, probably.
I am. The book is called The Life of Riley. It's not about radio, it's not an autobiography, it's a guide to healthy living. And if you'd have asked me, name 100 people you know who may write a book about healthy living, you would not have made that list, Phil Riley.
Thank you very much. No, I probably wouldn't. And the real genesis of the book was a period a couple of years ago when a number of things happened. First of all, three very good friends of mine, two of them friends of yours died within the space of 6 months of each other. And they're all sort of our age, guys in their mid-50s, early 60s. And that really caught me short. And in fact, just before that, I had a terrible accident, which I know you know about because I described it on a blog I wrote, where I sliced my forearm open and almost killed myself in the corner of the garden. And me having this sort of second chance because I'd had this accident, which I'd luckily nothing untoward has happened and my hand's perfectly okay, but I could easily have sliced my aorta. And then these three friends of mine not getting a second chance and, you know, going to their funerals made me think, well, I just want to know what's going on here. Why are some people dying 30, 40 years before other people? What is it about lifestyle that's having this effect on people? And if it is a lifestyle-related thing, can you change that lifestyle? And if you can change it, will it have an effect? And if you can change it, can you sort of package it into something that works for people? Because that's the other thing, is it's all very well to say, change your lifestyle, but most people will go, yeah, but that's pretty hard. So you've got to find a way of doing that works for people.
Absolutely. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but I want to talk about radio, because I know you through radio.
You do.
And I want to know, first of all, why radio? What was it about radio that you thought, this has to be my career?
When I was a teenager, it was 1974-75, when commercial radio was just starting, and BBC local radio, about the same time, didn't they? They grew up together. And I was fascinated by gadgets and gizmos. So this is back in the 70s. There weren't gadgets and gizmos like there are today.
No, but sure.
Cassette machines and tape recorders and record players, I loved playing with them and plugging one into the other and trying to do stuff with them. That was really interesting. And I also loved music. And I know everybody likes music, but I really was a passionate music fan. And the final thing was I went to a school, like you, a grammar school lad, and the school that I went to had a great drama department. And I ended up on stage on a few performances and thought, I actually quite like performing. And it was that combination of gadgets, music, performing that all came together and made me think, actually, radio probably ticks a lot of those boxes. Yeah. I'm too tall and not good looking enough to be on TV. So those things were how I ended up being in radio. And I've, you know, crikey, luckily for me, I've never had to work a day in my life because I've been in radio the whole thing.
I always say that. Who did you listen to when you were a kid then? Who was the person you would stop everything for when they were on the radio?
Well, it was somebody who now, I think, still works in BBC local radio. At the time, he was on Piccadilly. It was Andy Peebles, who used to do the Soul Show. And Roger Day, who was also another doyen of radio. It was a local thing for me rather than necessarily the big guys on Radio 1. Tony Blackburn was the breakfast DJ on Radio 1 at the time. I saw him last night at a radio do, so it's great to see that he's still going. He obviously has read the stuff inside The Life of Riley, but, you know, sadly, some of the guys that I knew at the time, they're no longer here, so.
What is it about radio presenters' mums? Because your mum told you exactly the same thing as my mum told me when I first started in radio. And that was...
Get a proper job.
Get a proper job. And it was about 4 or 5 years before my mum finally thought that, oh, actually, yeah, this might be a career.
I think most people who end up doing what you do for a living, I don't do it anymore, which is sitting in a room on your own yapping away for 3 hours. Yeah. Most people would look at that and say, well, they're pretty odd. And I suppose if it's your mother looking at you doing that, she's really going to say, he's a bit odd. I'm a bit worried about my son doing that. So it's perfectly normal, I think, for mums to express some concern. And also, at the time when I first got my break. Radio didn't pay very well, and of course you're going to tell me that it still doesn't pay very well.
Well, it still don't. I remember the first wage packet I got when you were my boss, but let's not go there. What are your radio highlights from when you were a presenter then?
Well, I was digging out some pictures the other day because one of the newspapers that was doing an interview with me about the book said, oh, you know, did you interview anybody famous? And actually, in the 80s, I did meet some, you know, very famous people at the time. I interviewed Gladys Knight and the Pips, the Bee Gees, a whole bunch of people. It was, I had a great time. I was the last person, this is rather sad story, but I was the last person to ever interview Arthur Lowe.
He was in Birmingham, wasn't he?
And I interviewed him in the morning, and he was doing a matinee performance at the Alex of a play that he was in, and we had a perfectly charming interview. And at the end of it, he got up and left, and I remember saying to the producer after he'd gone, I said, he looked a bit drunk. And I know it sounds odd now. Mm. I said, he just looked as though he was slurring his words. And of course, he was obviously having the heart attack that then killed him later on that morning or that lunchtime, because he died. I'm not sure if he died on stage or certainly backstage in the theatre. So I was the last person to ever interview him, but actually learned a very interesting thing about interviewing people, which was, it was a perfectly pleasant interview, but there was nothing absolutely gripping about it. And later on in the afternoon, I was in the newsroom, and one of the journalists who was one of the senior guys there said, Arthur Lowe, hold on a second. And he pulled out a drawer, and in the drawer were cassettes, because in those days you would interview and save it on cassette. And he pulled out this cassette and said, I've got Arthur Lowe here. And he whizzed through the interview that he'd done with Arthur Lowe years before, and the last question was, Arthur, how do you want people to remember you?
Wow.
And Arthur Lowe gave a brilliant 20-second, well, whatever I think, people are going to remember me as Captain Mannering, etc. And it was just a great answer. And the journalist said to me, that's how you finish. Always finish an interview with, how do you want to be remembered?
Right,
because when people shuffle off this mortal coil, you'll have the great thing to run in the news bulletin. So,
all right, I won't ask you that. You're all right. Phil Riley is my guest. His book, The Life of Riley, is all about changing your life and living longer. We'll chat more with Phil in just a moment. Springsteen and Born to Run here at BBC Radio Oxford. Phil Ruddy, my guest, a former smoker, a former clinically obese and chronically unfit and heavy drinking kind of guy.
That was
who was turned his life around with his new book, Life of Riley. You're going to have Springsteen played at your funeral, aren't you?
That's right. Yeah, well, my cremation. When I'm going out in style, and that will be playing as I go into the fiery furnace.
Marvellous. Because you love Springsteen.
I do.
And you've followed him around the world.
What
is the furthest you've travelled to see Bruce play?
I took my wife earlier this year to Milwaukee. And I have to say, before we went to Milwaukee, I had no idea where it was. And we'd got a little window, and it was our sort of 30th anniversary of being together. And I thought, I've got to do something. And I looked at the diary and saw, got 4 days. And Bruce is playing Milwaukee. Well, if I knew where Milwaukee was, that might mean that we're going to, and I sort of went onto Google Maps and scanned back and said, it's not that far from Chicago. I could probably get to Chicago. So we went to Chicago, and I didn't tell Jean, my wife, until we actually were on the train, the Hiawatha Express from Chicago to Milwaukee. I said, she'd probably guessed by then.
Yeah,
we're actually going to see Bruce tonight. And that was fantastic. And that tour is coming here in June. So if you're either heading up the motorway a bit to Coventry or going down a bit to Wembley, you'll see pretty much the same concert that we saw in Milwaukee. So if you're a Bruce fan, fantastic.
Fantastic. This book, it's got lots of statistical analysis in it.
That's me, yeah.
I know it's you, but of course, how do you turn that into layman's English? Because it has to be read by those that aren't as interested in stats as I think the
stats are there simply in order for people to feel comfortable, I hope, that somebody that isn't a scientist, that doesn't claim to have that expert scientific knowledge, has done enough research and has done enough thinking and analysis that when he says, actually, you can get from this age to this age if you change this, that people go, actually, it looks as though he's got the backing and the background to be able to justify that. So that's why the stats are in there and the graphs. But really, the book is simply saying, here are things that will kill you before your time, and they are drinking too much too frequently, smoking, as most people probably know, being obese, not necessarily just being overweight, but being, you know, the wrong side of that that line and being obese and not doing any physical activity. And those things are all changeable. And you don't need to convert from a couch potato, 25 stone, you know, smoker into a triathlete, monk-like person. It's getting a moderate shift in your lifestyle will deliver nearly all of those benefits.
Because this is something that you followed yourself. You are, yeah. you are the proof, of the pudding.
Well, I was. Well, at the time you knew me and I was your boss back in the late 90s, around about 2000, I at one point weighed over 20 stone. Now, I'm a tall guy.
Yeah. What, you're 6'5".
Yeah, but I weighed over 20 stone and I was, at that point, I was clinically obese. And when I stood on the scales, I had one of those scales that tells you how fat you are. And it,
one person at a time, please.
It didn't say, get off, please. It actually said 40% body fat. And I worked it out and it meant that I was effectively carrying around two suitcases worth of fat with me every day. You know, the heavy suitcase when you put them on the scales at the airport and they say 20 or 25 kilograms. I was carrying two of those round. So I knew I had to do something to sort that out. And I managed to get my weight down to the point where I was overweight but not obese. But it's not until the last couple of years that I did the research for the book that I've really grasped exactly what you need to do in what order and what, you know, sort of permutation in order to really bring my weight down. Now I weigh 14 stone 7 and I've weighed 14 stone 7 for about the past year, and it took me a year to come down from about 17.5 to 14.5, and I'm still there today.
Five simple daily habits. Talk us through them, Phil.
Well, I mean, I call them secret habits. I think there was a publisher suggested I put the word secret in the title. They're not secret, really. They're just a combination of things that all work together cohesively. The first thing is you've got to have a good breakfast. And a good breakfast is something that is either egg-based, so a scrambled eggs or boiled eggs. You can put a bit of protein in there, ham or salmon or something. Or for me, it's porridge. So porridge for me. Not cereal, not toast, because if you eat cereal or toast, you'll be hungry again 2 or 3 hours later. So something like porridge, which keeps you going for quite some time. Because habit two is skipping lunch. And it's one of the habits that people go, whoa, I can't do that.
Well, but actually, people wouldn't advise that. They would just...
Well, the people that don't advise it don't know what they're advising. This eats small and often is completely the wrong advice.
So is this kind of like an inbuilt 5-2 diet?
There's a bit of fasting in it, yes. So going between breakfast and dinner is part of the structure, and it's a bit like if you read the 5-2 diet, you're supposed to fast 2 days a week. But it's not fasting like that, because dinner is, you know, you can eat as much as you want for dinner, but the food you eat has got to be the right food. So it's got to be meat or fish and vegetables, salad, just not carbohydrates.
Right, there has to be a bit of exercise in this as well, I guess.
Yeah, but the exercise, which is habit three, is walking. You don't need to do anything more than walk, but you need to walk briskly, and you need to do it most days of the week, and you need to do 30 minutes or so. But you really don't need to buy Lycra. You don't need to buy a
thank
bike.
Thank heaven for that.
Yeah, you don't need to do anything manic. You don't need to join a gym. You just need to get out and walk purposefully, briskly, for 30 minutes plus a day.
And is this 7 days a week, or do you have days off?
Only Monday to Thursday. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, don't go mad, but you can relax at the weekends.
Yeah.
Because one of the big things that people find terribly problematic about any attempt to change things is the feeling that you're on a treadmill, you can't get off. The stickability of diets and other types of, that's the real problem with lots of these
things. Absolutely.
So being able to say, I'm going to do this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but Friday, Saturday, Sunday,
there's light at the end of the tunnel.
It means it makes it a lot easier to get back on the following Monday and the Monday after and the Monday after. And it certainly, I have to say, for me, it's been transformational.
Yeah absolutely. Are you a big sports fan as well?
I am.
Manchester United, actually born in Manchester as well.
I am, but yes,
so
one of the few, Nick.
So
yes,
can't even take the mickey.
Yeah.
When was it that your wife realised that two of your kids are named after former Man United managers then?
Well, Alexandra and Matthew are two lovely children of mine, and we jointly chose their names.
Did you
and
really?
It's just a happenstance, Nick. I don't want you to get the impression that I would pull a farcer on my wife.
Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
It was a very enjoyable read the other night when I was talking through it. And I actually walked. This is how much I've taken on board. I actually walked to my local railway station today, which was 1.4 miles
away. That's brilliant. Exactly what you need to do. Well done.
Phil, thank you very much indeed. Cheers.
BBC Radio Oxford.